This is part three of a three-part podcast.
I think that I'm not sure if you're familiar with this expression. I actually learned it from one of my listeners about church, and I think it applies here a little bit. But give me a moment. I need to. But this person said that church is not a showcase for saints. It is a hospital for sinners. And so I kind of wonder if that might be said for the school of nonviolent communication. People come to the school because they're struggling in this space and wish to be better. And it's possible that a lot of the people that have struggled with communication issues in the past, they're using this tool and they're possibly misusing the tool because they have not yet quite mastered it. But they've certainly tried for a long, long time. So the amount of time you have in studying and mastering nonviolent communication does not necessarily equate to mastery.
Well, interest in a topic doesn't, and a method doesn't make you good at it. And needing to use it for yourself because you recognize at some level that you might be harming people or feeling harmed and you want to be better at this, better at communication, doesn't mean you're going to be good at it. But I think it's worth a try. I mean, I believe in any kind of thing that is an attempt to make your life and other lives better. Hence, those of us who start and or live in or advocate intentional communities of all kinds, co-housing, eco-villages, every kind, the kind you've mentioned, Paul, shared group households in urban areas and now rural, I think this is better than nothing. We might not be good at it. We might be stumbling in on a big, steep learning curve, but at least we're on the learning curve, right? Better than to not give it a try. Wouldn't you say, Paul, that a person who wants to design a permaculture landscape and only partially understands the design principles and designs a landscape where there's way too much labor, not enough long and protracted observation, and they're not getting a very high yield and things are going goofy, at least the person's given it a try. They're going to learn, because further long and protracted observation of what's not working will help them realize they have to put the water uphill, not downhill, and things like that. They'll learn. It's worth a try, don't you think?
I think that that is true. And it's a big part of what the mission here is, where I believe I'm gardening gardeners.
Good.
And I like the idea of having many, many people here all trying and each learning from their neighbor. I mean, I like the idea that it's like we could possibly have 20 people that feel like they're very advanced in the field of horticulture as well as permaculture and possibly biodynamic and a few others, and then each expressing what they believe is their best vision, and then those ideas cross-pollinate. Mm-hmm. We just completed a Rocket Mass Heater Innovators gathering, and we brought together the five leading innovators to play for 5 days.
Really? Well, who did you have?
So we had Ernie and Erica Wisner. We had Tim Barker. Peter Vandenberg, and Matt Walker.
Wow.
Each person, I mean, the cross-pollination was amazing. And it's like we just kind of put a big jetpack on the back of Rocket Mass Heaters, and this was only after like a week. Not only did so much get accomplished, but then it's like between Ernie and Peter talking about a thing. So Ernie tried to make a 10-inch system, and then Peter said, well, what about an 8-inch system that was a batch system? And so next thing you know, apparently this is the first time an 8-inch batch system has ever been done. Peter brought in some measuring equipment, and we were able to get 94% efficiency on burns, which some of the best conventional wood stoves with some catalytic converters in them are getting about 85%, but the catalytic converter burns out every couple of years.
So did you videotape this of it?
Oh, we got tons of video and pictures.
Wonderful.
And we made a podcast, and so we've got lots of, but the thing is that this cross-pollination moved things forward. And I think it's one of those things where it's like, because one of the things when I was very frustrated when I first started studying community intensively in 2005, which led to me meeting you, was like, I want to move forward and do the innovative visionary kind of thing, but I'm concerned about how design by committee is often leads to failure. And, you know, like you look at Sepp Holzer and he's accomplished so much, but, you know, he did not do that within a community setting, but I'm feeling like community is so critical, such a critical component. And so how do you do this? And at this point in time in my life, and I could still be wrong and 5 years from now I'll have a whole different idea, but right now I think that the idea is that rather than design by committee or like I'm the great designer and everybody will do as I say, that those two models are not going to work. They are not effective. But what is effective is to facilitate 20 different visionaries, 20 different artisans, 20 different people with 20 different views on what is best. And that if they can simply express their view in seed and soil or whatever, in permaculture, then the others will be able to observe and see that. And then oftentimes, as with any artisan will look at another artist's work and say, that's shit. That artist is such a shitty artist. But there is one thing they're doing with blues that they almost have right. And I'm going to now enter into my blue period, and I'm going to show you how to really do blue. And so that kind of thing, this cross-pollination of brilliance feeding brilliance, then I want to see permaculture move forward. And so I'm wanting to embrace the differences. So granted, you know, like we're both discussing, communication is so critically important for so many different things. And at the same time, I've come to my own conclusions and philosophies, which I've attempted to express over hundreds of podcasts. And, you know, I get the impression that there are people that, there are a few, like this 1 in 100,000 person that feels aligned with what I say. Like they feel, they agree.
Mm-hmm.
Like, wholeheartedly with the things that I'm saying and the things that I advocate. But this is a rare thing. It's very different from what most folks in intentional community believe. And then so I'm going to hopefully draw these people here and we will experiment together.
Yeah. Well, you know, Paul, it seems to me that there's at least two ways to do the shared resources and the shared infrastructure and the cooperation of spending less money and having more satisfaction when living in community. And one way is the way many communities do it, where they have shared participatory decision-making, and they co-create the place. And another way of doing it is the way you're doing it, which I think is absolutely fine. So what I do is I address the issues of co-creating a community together, and I address specifically and with a whole lot of interest different governance and decision-making methods. I think there are methods that have some reputation or some aura or glamour of being a certain harmonious thing, but in fact they don't create harmony at all. And then there are governance methods that I think that work better. But whether it's consensus or sociocracy or holocracy or supermajority voting or whatever the group uses for their decision-making method and for their governance structure, if they're doing it well and doing it correctly the way it's been designed to do and the way it'll work well, then they're going to do fine if they are qualified to use it in the first place, because there's criteria to use these things. Like, you got to be on the same page for what your mission and purpose is. But if they're doing it incorrectly, as I see many people do, then they're going to have a terrible time in their community. And a person could draw the conclusion that there's something wrong with community, that it doesn't work, that you need to have a one boss kind of a thing because it doesn't work. And I would say, whoops, that's not it. It's that their governance is not being done correctly or helpfully or effectively. So what I do is I actually think of myself as kind of like a permaculture designer, researcher person in the design of communities, not the landscape of your home site or your farm or your garden, but the landscape of how do you create a community. And so I've got all these design principles, like share the surplus, you know, that kind of thing. And I've got these like specific practical techniques that can work in different situations. So when I go around and talk to various groups, and I say, hey, can I stay here tonight and have dinner with you all and get a tour? And if you'd like me to do an informal consultation on any things that you might want to ask me about, that if I can help with, let's do it. So they say, yeah, let's do it. So then I get this easel paper and flip chart thing, and I say, what, would you let me know? We'll write them down, the things you really enjoy about living in your community and the things you might find challenging currently. Well, I'm doing this partly because it feels good for them and partly because they want to tell me what's challenging, and this gives them a way to do it. So I write this stuff down, and I look at the challenging things, and I group them together under topics, because there's generally about 6 or 7 or 8 basic things that go wrong in communities. Only that many. Not a lot, just that many. And sometimes people will express it in different ways, and they'll say, I think this is really the same thing. I'll put it together. And then I'll say, well, look, fortunately, I know some things that can address this and help resolve it. Shall I tell you? And they say, yeah. So then I share with them what I've learned. So a couple of years ago, I was in Germany at this very, very famous income-sharing commune called Kommune Niederkaufungen near the town of Kassel, Germany. They were having some difficulty with their decision-making, and I shared with them a technique that was developed 25 years earlier in Davis, California, by a group of folks who turned a student housing co-op into a community which is now called in-street co-housing. So I say they have an in-street consensus method because their method is so good. I shared it with these folks in Germany. A couple of years later, they wrote and said they're using it. They're so much happier. I put an article series in Communities Magazine called Busting the Myth that Consensus with Unanimity is Good for Communities. I wanted to bust that myth. It's a myth, in my opinion, and I just laid out all these reasons why I thought it really didn't work well. I did a whole series on that. I did 4 articles. One of them was about the in-street method. There was a guy at a community here in North Carolina, not my community, but a different one, who wrote in a letter to the editor, and he said, my God, I'm glad finally somebody has said this out loud. Our community is 22 years old. It's still as beautiful as it ever was. Our gardens are beautiful. Our homes are beautiful. And our meetings are a dysfunctional nightmare. He said, I can't believe anybody wrote what you wrote, because I thought that what you're supposed to say in the communities movement is everybody gets along well and we're all fine and we're all wonderful and consensus works great and it makes us all happy and harmonious, like the books and the consensus trainers say. And he said something similar to what you say in your previous podcast, which is that communities seem as if they're designed as if all of us are noble, but only some are noble and others behave in ways that yuck. And then he said, consensus has the implied philosophical background that we're all equivalent and that we're all going to behave wonderfully. And he said, but in the luck of the draw of any group of folks that you get, you're going to get some people who had childhoods that would make you weep and then who behave really pretty badly in their grown-up life. And we have 3 blockers. Every time I go to a community and they have chronic blockers, it's always 3 chronic blockers. We have 3 chronic blockers, and he told me what was going on. He said it in a letter to the editor in Communities Magazine. So I contacted him and said, hey, where are you? What's the name of your community? Let's visit. And it turns out I met him the other night, because he's in another part of the state where I just did a talk. Anyway, I shared with him about in-street consensus method. I sent him a thing. I also had an article in the magazine. It's been 2 years since then. He introduced that method to them, and now they're doing better. How about that? The method of governance and decision-making can make a difference in the level of heartbreak, demoralization, exhaustion, and feeling awful in your community.
Plus, forward velocity.
Oh, yeah, because forward velocity helps people feel good, especially those folks on the far left. And my own community here, oh, my God, I can't believe what we did. We had consensus with unanimity with no recourse if anybody blocked. We had this for 18 years. We're now 20 years old. That meant anybody could block anything at any time for any reason, and there could be no recourse. That also meant that a person wouldn't have to block a proposal. They could just say, when we're talking in the kitchen, I would never support that. And the proposal never even gets created and never even comes to the meeting. Why? Because we know that person will block it. Or that person could say, over my dead body, or that person could say, and I don't mean that person, I mean different people, could say, I hate that, I would never, ever, I'd block it. Okay, so there's overt threatening to block, and then there's just raising your eyebrow. Hey, I'm thinking I might like to get a working dog to help keep the varmints out of my garden. And the person just raises their eyebrow, and you know about their beliefs that any animals that are working animals are actually slaves, and you're a slave owner if you have a pet. So then you know that you can't even ever bring it up. So you lose a lot of good ideas because they're stopped ahead of time. Why? By threats to block, even if they're not overt. Okay? So our community was hamstrung like that for years. And the people who did the blocking and the threatening to block didn't know they did. They were unaware of it. When you tried to talk to them about it, they would not know what you were talking about. So what did we lose? We lost either through withdrawing from governance, the people on the far left, or they moved away. So we had a brain drain here. Of course, the people on the far right would go, good riddance, I hated that guy. And that's because they were afraid of him and were not enjoying being treated with impatient words and critical words by those left side people. Okay, so we slowly changed our government incrementally. So here's how it is right now. We do all the consensus stuff, proposals, facilitator, agenda, we discuss it, and so on. When it comes to time to make the decision, we vote. If it's 85% or more, we pass it. If it's 50% or less, it doesn't have enough support to pass. If it's between 50% and 85%, it doesn't have enough support to pass, but we use the in-street method, which is solution-oriented meetings between some of the people who voted no and some who voted yes to come up with a new proposal that addresses the same issues as the old one so that no votes, or in the case of consensus, blocks, don't stop us from actually trying to solve the problem. Then, once we come up with the new one, probably it'll pass because look who created it. But if the group can't come up with a new proposal, the old one comes back for a 66% supermajority vote. This is very similar to the in-street method, except that we threw out blocking altogether. We just vote. It's radical. I've never heard of a community doing this.
So it's superer than a supermajority.
It's what?
It's superer. I just made up this word, superer.
Oh,
superer.
Yes.
It's more
well,
super.
I would say it's a supermajority, which is a term. It's a supermajority, but it has parts to it that allow stopped proposals to have another chance, just getting rewritten in a better way with the advocates of the proposal and those who said no. But if that doesn't help, we bring back the first one.
You know, I think when a lot of people start discussing consensus-based systems and, you know, what's going to work and what's going to not work, a lot of them choose to not be very interested because it's like, well, it's really obvious. You take everybody wearing a white hat and you keep them, and then those people wearing a black hat, you just tell them to piss off and get out of here. Then everything will work fantastically.
What is this analogy to, Paul?
Well, I'm going somewhere with this, and that is that I think that when people are analyzing consensus-based systems, or when they're considering what system to use or what would be a great system or whatever, then they start seeing people with white hats and black hats, and the decisions are then obvious. Well, take those people that are screwing everything up and then send them down the road, and then everything will be fine. But there was one time you told me about something where it's like, wow, that really makes you think. And then this is the ultimate scenario to try, and when you're trying to design your system, your decision-making system, or figure out which decision-making system to embrace, that this is the perfect scenario. And and you described it for me that there would be people in a community where it's like, let's do this thing for our community. It will be amazing and awesome, and I'll even do all the work. And if everybody chips in like $70, then we can have this epic, awesome thing. and we will all love it. And then there are other people that are like, what we have now is the ultimate of awesome. Just sit in your rocking chair and drink in the wonderful beauty that we have. Stop trying to turn this into a construction zone and add things which will just make it worse. So it's these two views that they're both so delicious. One view, let's make a community house that's a cob cordwood thing. It'll be all awesome. We just need to get a few materials, and those of us that love to do this will do it. And then the other party that's like, we have too much stuff already. Let's stop building stuff for the sake of building stuff. And sometimes the discussion would be possibly about, let's add a road in because this road is like not doing it. Or let's overhaul our road and improve our road. So that way it's not this terrible, disastrous, dangerous thing. And then the other people are like, no, let's keep the road horrible because we shouldn't be using roads anyway. We should be walking or riding a bike. And the road we have is perfectly lovely for a bicycle. And, you know, I don't want to put my funds into this. I like being where I am right now. And when you described this to me, and I believe this was about 4 years ago, then I thought, oh, this is perfect. Because I think everybody could see both sides. And it's like, you know, you talk about forward velocity. Forward velocity can mean so many things to so many different people. And it's like, what a perfect example of, and I believe when you described this scenario to me, that the community in question was divided 50-50 on this topic. Half the community felt that where we are now is perfect. Please don't change it. And the other half were like, but that's why I joined community, is to do amazing things and all these cool eco things and make a beautiful, bright future. And the right way, as opposed to, you know, so then what an excellent example of where, how do you get, you know, what is your decision-making process then? But, of course, your solution is that clearly there was something going on when people were joining the community about what kind of community are we? And yet now people have kind of built their homes there. This is their home. And no one wants to leave, so.
Well, what you're describing, Paul, is a classic dilemma that happens in communities that have what I call a certain kind of structural conflict. So I'm going to back up a sec and say that structural conflict is a term I made up for the kind of conflict that happens in newly forming communities as well as existing ones when the founders and early members did not put certain crucial structures in place. And I say structures, but I don't really know what I mean. I mean, it's not the right word. Maybe it should be design features. Maybe it should be things, except some of them aren't things. They're processes.
Philosophies.
Anyway, no, not philosophies. I would say design features.
Okay.
That means either a noun or a verb, right? A thing or a process, okay? But they didn't put them in place. And later on, there's big conflict because the community needs that thing, whatever it is, and they don't have it, and then they have lots of conflict, and now they're having interpersonal conflict on top of the reason on the thing they don't have. But they don't know they need that thing, because how would they know? They never created a community before, and until I wrote my first book, there wasn't even any book you could read that says, here's what tends to work well. So, innocently and without meaning any harm, they just forgot to put a certain thing in that they never knew they should have. And the lack of that thing is what I call structural conflict. One of the kinds of structural conflict is when the community didn't have a crystal clear, absolutely obvious, not vague, not ambiguous, but clear description of why they're there and what they're doing. Because if it's clear why they're there and what they're doing, when they later have resources of time or labor or money that they could spend on something, they won't have fights like the one you just described. They won't have people saying, I don't want to spend the money on that. I don't care about that. And they won't have people saying, but we must spend the money on this. Because they just look at what their mission is, and if it goes along with their mission, they do it. They might have enough money to do one thing but not two, or one thing that costs more or costs less, but those are not issues of structure. Those are issues of strategy, or which one do we do first and which one do we do second. You see what I mean?
I do. I do see what you mean.
And therefore, communities that are trying to get started new, or those that already exist, could create for themselves horrible conflict later, which is what I'm trying to help them prevent, if they don't have a crystal clear mission. A community that I knew of, which I actually have visited, and when I went there, I saw, oh my gosh, this isn't actually a community, even though they've been using that word for years. It was a privately owned place where various people lived, and they did educational programs sometimes. They called it a community. But once upon a time, a long time ago, when there were more people living there, and they all thought they were living in what they would call a community, they had this horrible, horrible conflict, which was that some people wanted to put money, time, and energy into tours and workshops and having people learn cool sustainability things. And other people didn't want to do that because they didn't want the damn visitors and tourists and other people traipsing all over their home and their woods and their meadow and their front yard. They didn't want those damn strangers walking around. They wanted to just live their nice life in community. The problem wasn't that these people were having fights with those other people who were all wrong. The problem existed at the beginning of the founding of the community because it wasn't clear. And the guy who owned the land, he would invite anybody to come and live there no matter what they thought the community was for. So they'd get these people who had two different views that were kind of mutually exclusive. So when they were trying to make a decision, do we help bring more visitors here with our visitor center and our tours and our workshops, or don't we? It was 50-50. They didn't want to. They had no idea what the problem was. So a friend of mine who's a permaculture designer, actually, I guess I better not say his name because then people might know what community we mean, but anyway, he was asked to be a consultant to them, which is pretty cool because his expertise was in, it was in permaculture design. But he went there and he gave them a survey to find out why they were there. And he tallied and collated the survey results and said to them, 50% of you believe that you're here for this. 50% of you believe that you're here for that. It did not solve their problem because who's going to move?
Right, right.
And so they were in a very bad stuck place, but at least now they knew why. So when I talk about this kind of structural conflict, I say you've got two problems. One is that you've got this situation going on where you don't have a clear mission and purpose and vision and why you're there. And the second problem is the many different things. This is just the latest one that comes up because you want to spend your resources of time, money, and energy in completely different ways. Why? Because you want to fulfill the mission of community. Oh, yeah, what is the mission? Well, it's this. No, it's that. No, it's this. No, it's that. Put up your dukes. Okay, you're a jerk. You're an asshole. But what is it? Nobody's a jerk or an asshole. They just innocently joined a community thinking it was about A or B, and they never talked to each other about, is it A or B? Well, when they find out, at least they know why they're fighting, but it doesn't really solve it. Who is supposed to move away?
So I want to move on to another topic, and I am running out of time for today.
So am I, actually.
Yeah. And so
let's go to that other topic and finish it up, and then we'll pick up other topics another time.
Yes, I've got four items left on my list just for things I thought would like take us half an hour, and we'd move into all the other things.
Okay.
But I want to at least get rid of this piece of paper. So first item is a very simple thing. I have retaken up a book that I read decades ago, and as I'm about a quarter of the way into reading it again now, and I'm realizing that many of my values come directly from this piece of fiction, which you have a kind of a comedic tie-in to. And that is, I'm rereading Ecotopia.
Oh, I love Ecotopia. I lived in the backyard of the man who wrote it. I used to tell my friends I lived in Ecotopia.
I am shocked as I'm reading this, like the things that I currently openly advocate I'm finding them in this book.
And this was written in 1972.
And it's kind of like I remember reading it, thinking I so seriously enjoyed the book, and I could only remember a couple of the details. So, for example, one of the things that I remember reading in the book that I embrace now is to avoid the use of paint. I don't, forbid it or anything like that, but it's like, okay, how can we minimize the use of paint, which drives my brother nuts. But he is making a gallant effort to re-engineer things so we use less paint. And I think we use probably, you know, I'm going to guess 8% of the paint that most other, like an organic farm would use. We use hardly any paint. And we're very particular about it. I know Jocelyn would very much like to repaint the inside of the house, but I'm weird about it. And I'm reading it, of course, again in Ecotopia, but there's all these other things about how people, how every, the buildings are being, have been reworked in Ecotopia to be something where generally, instead of it being one family per household, it's like 20 people live communally in one building.
We should probably tell people that Ecotopia is a novel written in 1972 by Ernest Kallenbach, known to his friends as Chick Kallenbach. So if I refer to him as Chick, that's who I mean. And it was about an American guy who goes to this country called Ecotopia, which was Northern California, Washington, and Oregon, that seceded from the Union in the future being 1984, which came and went, and that didn't happen. And they had a war with the U.S., which they won. They were able to secede successfully. And for 20 years, the U.S. hasn't been allowed into Washington, Oregon, or Northern California in order to see, to learn what they're doing. So this one journalist from, I think it was the New York Times, is that right? He goes there to try to find out what they're doing. And the book is one chapter, his journal entry into his private journal, and one chapter, a dispatch to the New York Times from what they're doing. So this is how the author, Chick Kallenbach, can get a lot of cool ecological ideas into the mind of the reader by putting him in this mythical country. Isn't that something?
It's profound and amazing, and I'm finding it to be especially delicious these days. I've stopped reading books years ago because I've been working 100 hours a week, and if I've got a spare moment where I have the capacity to read a book, I've got other things I really should be doing. And but I've gotten to the in the last few weeks, my personal overwhelm has got to be too much. And actually, we've spent a couple of days where it's like the thing I'm saying is like, look, I don't want to hear permaculture. Can you talk about anything? Talk about a book. Talk about a movie. Talk about music. I just can't hear about permaculture right now. And a lot of it is, in fact, a lot of it is rooted in community, our community problems. And in this case, our community has been suffering from problems with the kitchen. And it's like we just got done with a 7-day event, and it's like the people that helped us prepare for the event were supposed to just simply enjoy the event, but suddenly they found themselves doing dishes for hours each day, and it's like, how the hell did this happen? And so then, instead of me enjoying the event, I'm finding that I'm spending large tracts of time talking to people about all of our community problems, which is our community design. Rather than consensus, rather than something where everybody talks to everybody, then the downside of this particular design that we have here is that I have to hear everybody out whenever they want to be heard. And so I was spending hours, many, many hours every day hearing them out and trying to help come up with solutions to these problems. And so I didn't get to really enjoy the event. And a lot of the people here didn't get to really enjoy the event. But the people who paid, who were not part of our community and came short term, they got to enjoy the event.
Mm-hmm.
So currently we're looking for a person. This is a paid position here.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been calling this person the kitchen commander, but really I think that the name is probably wrong. Really what we need is a level 9 mom. and I think I need to just reword this, rephrase it, but really I kind of feel like I've put out fewer videos, fewer podcasts, I've accomplished so much less because that I just assumed that we would have this person here. And this we have not, And because we have not had this person here, then all of my plans have been failing. And so instead of doing other things like new videos and podcasts and stuff, then I've been spending too much time trying to solve small problems that this level 9 mom would have totally taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm being drug in to talk about who cleans what and what is clean and we need more of this food and that food and what does it mean to do the dishes and who does which parts of the dishes and everybody washes their own plate and everything, but there's all these discussions of how to solve all these problems, and then as soon as you've solved it, then the new problem pops up. And really, if we had a level 9 mom here, I wouldn't have any of these discussions.
Mm-hmm.
It would all be taken care of. It mm-hmm. would all be solved. And hence the need for it to be a paid position. A person is paid. And I also feel like this is the kind of person that I've met. I've met hundreds of these people. And I'm going to say women. And for some reason, and that's another thing too, is it's bizarre. I know that there have been several occasions like, okay, we're all down here with the rocket mass heater. We're going to take this one apart and figure out how we can make it better. And what happened to all the women? Why aren't the women here? Where'd they all go? Are they not coming? And it's just a bunch of guys. And it's like, what happened? And so, they're all up doing things in the kitchen. And it's like, so as much as I wish to say that, I don't want to be sexist, it's like, this does seem to be the way that events keep dividing. There's this natural divide that keeps happening over and over and over again. All the women go over there to do kitchen things, and all the men are going down here to get covered in grime and mud and things. It seems to have happened repeatedly. There are exceptions, of course, but for the most part, that seems to be the divide that we have. It narrows down, the bottom line is, this is our problem. We don't have a level 9 mom. And I have been leaning too heavily on the idea that this person would be here, or that this person would show up, or, that the solution would naturally present itself. Because this is my weak area. I'm very weak in this area, and so I thought that this would be solved by now, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Well, you had some other topics you wanted to talk about.
True. So I've said the level 9 mom thing, done. Two things are left. Actually, one of them I've already talked about, that was done. The last item on this piece of paper is a phrase that you introduced to me. And maybe it'll turn out to be this puppet in my head. And that is nomadic youth.
Oh, yeah.
Please share with my listeners what this means and why it matters to community.
Okay. I got this phrase from a man here at Earth Haven called Paul, who refers to the young people who visit various different communities and sustainability education centers and organic farms. They might be work exchangers. They might be a woofer under the woofing program. Willing workers own organic farms. And they sometimes join communities, or they do if the community is inexpensive enough to join, or there's no joining fee, which happens once in a while. And they're there for a while, and then they leave. And why they leave is because they wanted to go to Tibet, or maybe they wanted to go to Kenya, or maybe they wanted to go to France, or they have some kind of fabulous other opportunity to learn and have adventures. So off they go. And you can't blame them. They're at the time in their life when being nomadic and free and able to go have experiences and adventures is exactly what their life is calling for. It's part of the impulse for them. So I highly suggest that communities have what I call work exchange programs, where you ask people who, they don't have to be youth, they don't have to be nomadic youth, they can be of any age, but they're very often young, and in that stage in life where they can afford to take the time to do this, they come to your community and you give them a place to stay and live, which might be a room in a dorm, it might be their own room, or it might be a a campsite and they bring their tent. You provide them food, you provide them with a kitchen or an outdoor kitchen, or you provide community meals and they eat with all the community members, and you provide them facilities for toilet and shower and stuff like that that you need, and then they do work for you for some number of hours a week. Here at Earth Haven, it's 24 hours a week. What you get from them is you get to meet them, you get their energy, you get the pleasure of their company, their stories and tales from the road that they'll tell you, and you get their labor for free, except you're paying for food and you paid to provide the facilities that they're staying in. And so this is pretty common in communities, work exchangers. So we have them, and some communities call them apprentices, some call them interns, they call them different things. But basically, it's a trade. Some communities, you, the work exchanger, you pay the community for the privilege of doing this. Other communities, the community pays you. Most communities, no money is exchanged. It's just a trade. A community called Emerald Earth had a really cool work exchanger program. This community is in Northern California. And what they did was they said, okay, we want you to commit to come for 6 months. Don't come for less. Come for 6 months. The first 3 months, you pay for your food. When we find that we really like you and you're working out really well, please continue to stay for the next 3 months and we'll pay for your food. That's kind of cool because it's like a provisionary time.
Huh.
What the people who are work exchangers get is that they get to live in community. They get to have dinner with all of you interesting folks. They get to go to community meetings and sit in and observe. No, they can't interrupt or talk or have airtime or make decisions, but what they do is they observe and they learn. Okay, so what else do they get? Is they get to use a community hot tub and a community sauna, and they get to hang out with all you cool folks, and they get a sense of what your community is like. And what do you get? Free labor. Well, almost free. Plus the pleasure of their company. Now, sometimes it works out that on their circuitry around the universe, they come back and become your member. They join you. Sometimes they never leave. They just become a member or a non-member resident. Some of the coolest folks we have here who live here at Earth Haven were once work exchangers.
So I've put some stuff into some podcasts before about these kinds of things, and I also know that there are some places like the Bullock Brothers where they don't call them woofers or interns or anything like that anymore. They call them skill builders. And I think it's because some people arrive with certain expectations under certain labels on what has to happen, and it's like, okay, we're gonna make something up and go with that, and then that way we don't have to hear about your crazy expectations. We've got our own program that we've set up, and it seems to me that usually the farms where they'll pay a stipend, like a weekly stipend of $30 a week or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, they're new. They're very, very new, and they don't seem to be able to attract people to their site without that. And then other places have built a reputation over decades,
yep.
and they've got a waiting list of 500 people that want in, and
yes.
So it's like, okay, you have to pay us
mm-hmm.
like $100, and we're going to sift through the applicants, and we'll let you know who got in.
Exactly. Yeah. The bigger, larger, older, and more fabulously appealing a place might be, the more that young people will apply to be a work exchanger. And the more you're brand new, the more that you don't have much to offer. You don't have a reputation, first of all. And secondly, maybe you don't have very many people there. Maybe it's just one person or a couple who are saying, hey, we would like you to come and stay with us, and you can enjoy community life. And the young person might think, what do you mean community life? There's only two of you. In which case, it's harder to attract. So one way to do that might be to pay them until you establish such a reputation that you don't need to offer the inducement of a stipend, and you can just have a straight old trade. And then after you get really, really well-known and highly desirable and your physical, social, and cultural infrastructure is very well built up, then you can ask them to pay you.
So even more than that, my understanding is from visiting with some people that, work with the WOOF organizations, that for for every farm that's available where they'll accept woofers, there are 7 woofers looking for a farm. So basically there's a shortage of farms. At the same time, I've visited with a lot of farmers that have had woofers, and I'd say 90% are of the position they will never have a woofer again. And so it's something where you have to be prepared and be able to work with the woofers and be prepared for what could come of it. And our experience so far is that you'll have somebody arrive. And in fact, my brother makes this amazing case. Like, if we're going to try and get something done, like we're going to try and build a woofati, and it's like, okay, well, let's take in that they come with no skills, and so you've got to kind of bring them up to speed and teach them a lot of things. And a lot of times, once you get them taught, then they leave because you know they've got other adventures to go do. But you get them up to speed, and then you're feeding them, and so there's a certain amount of expense in feeding them, and you know you're possibly going to a certain amount of expense to facilitating them, even if they're living in a tent. Then it's kind of like, all right, my brother does this thing. He draws out, here's how much you spent on these, and here's how much they got done.
Mm-hmm.
Here's how many tools they destroyed because they didn't know how to use them correctly, and rather than ask for help, they decided to just try something which destroyed the tool. And so the level of tool burn is about yay big. And so it's like there's all that kind of thing. And then here's how much it would cost if you just hired up professionals to come and build the woofati.
what I hear you doing is referring to ineffective use of tools that the community could use to get helpful work exchangers. And one is to have an application process that includes calling references, asking for and calling references, and interviewing the person on the phone and finding out stuff about them, not just saying, yeah, come, show up, not doing that. Don't do that. Have some kind of rigorous process. It's like a membership process, but it's not membership. It's just residenceship for a while. And the second thing that I hear isn't being done well enough when I hear this story is that they need supervision. They need to be taught and supervised. And only are they given tools to use when they can kind of really understand how you take care of tools. You tell them what your standards for taking care of tools are. I went and visited Findhorn Community, and after the garden shift was finished, all these folks went over to these buckets of sand and oil and scraped and cleaned their tools while they were singing some kind of nice spiritual song, cleaning their tools, and I thought, oh, my God, this is heaven. They know how to clean tools. So you see my point?
I do see your point, and I think your point is exceptionally accurate. And so I want to tell a story. We have forest that's so thick that it needs to be thinned, otherwise it's a fire hazard.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the function of the woofati, is to take this wood that would otherwise, you know, be cut and put into a pile and burned in the middle of winter,
mm-hmm.
and just goes up in the atmosphere, to take that same wood and make a building out of it.
Mm-hmm.
My position was we have electric chainsaws that are corded, and we've more recently gotten cordless electric chainsaws, but,
mm-hmm.
and it's like they only, of course, have a range within so far from the power source, which is oftentimes going to be, you know, an electric vehicle or a battery pack or something like that. That's, you know, so it's a corded thing. And versus, also, I would supply a bow saw, so a manual way of cutting down a tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you're learning logging, a bow saw is a wonderful thing because you're going to be very efficient in cutting out your wedge and then your back cut,
mm-hmm.
because it takes a long time if you're inefficient, and that's a lot of sweat.
Right.
And then I've got a tool that I have called the timber tool, which I think makes dropping trees 10 times safer. But people don't like to use it because it's heavy. And so instead, then my brother shows up, and he's like, "This is stupid. This is so slow. Here, use my chainsaw, gas powered, super powerful." and stinky.
Do these young work exchangers know how to use a chainsaw and how to use it safely?
What a beautiful question. What an awesome, that is the perfect question. That is, so here, then my brother comes to me later and says, your gappers, because we don't call them woofers, we call them gappers, because they're goofy about permaculture.
G-A-P, got it.
Yeah, and they have destroyed my equipment. Here's a bill for $1,000 to fix and repair my chainsaws.
Well, hey, brother of Paul, why did you loan him your chainsaw? That was dumb.
I say, you, sir, are an enabler. They were going to learn how to properly harvest a tree, and then you gave them something without my permission, without my knowledge. You took this upon yourself. And granted, you dropped trees so fast, and you showed them how you could drop trees so fast. And now they don't want to use the timber tool. Why would you use the timber tool when you can use a wedge? And, you know, you taught them your way.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I now show them a bow saw, it's like, this is stupid. It goes so slow. It's so slow. It's annoying. I don't want to take down another tree.
Well, here's the thing. Another hole in the process that I see, given this last part of the story, is that work exchangers have to sign a contract with you when they come, in my opinion. So I'm going to give you my opinionated
opinion. Okay, all right.
That they sign a contract, and the contract says, we will provide you this, and we will do these things. You will do these things. You will do the work we ask you to. You will use the tools we ask you to. You won't say, I won't do that anymore. It's too slow. You'll do what we teach you. And part of what you put in your sign, of what you're providing, besides the composting toilet and the camping space and all that, is you provide education and instruction.
I think that, you know, and this is where many farms fall short, and I'm sure that we have different reports from different people, but for a while there, we were peeling logs too much. And people are getting really sick of peeling logs. But for many farms, the thing is you need to provide education. And I think that that's something that we provide amply and simultaneously not nearly enough. And so there are some days riddled with education, and then people are very happy about the education. Of course, it may not be on an item that they wanted to really learn about, but later they might see the value of what they learned.
Uh-huh.
And then there's other days when it's like another day of peeling logs, and it's like this is not education. I got all the education in the first hour of peeling logs 7 days ago.
Well, so what? They're not there to dictate what it is they do. They're there to get the educational and personal experiences that they get. Too bad. Hey, I want to quote a permaculture trainer, a teacher that I liked so much when I lived in Colorado. Her name was and probably still is, Allison Peck. She lived in Boulder. And she said to me, she was one of the first permaculture teachers I ever met after I was introduced to permaculture by Jerome Osentowski of CRMPI, Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute. Anyway, I took one of his courses, and then through that I met various other permaculture teachers in Colorado where I lived. And Allison said to me one day, people don't realize it, but working in your yard, in your landscape, implementing your permaculture design is hard, heavy, and dirty work. And I said, oh, my God. It was so true. I mean, it was one of those moments. I never forget it, and I still didn't forget it. And when I'm in my yard doing these things over and over for hours, I know very well that she's right. And I'm thinking, people think permaculture is such a cool, way cool design system, stacked functions, higher yields, less work, la, la, la. But when you're setting the whole thing up, man, you do a lot of hard and heavy and dirty work. So these people want to come to a permaculture design laboratory farm community place and enjoy what you all have to offer, peel the damn logs, and quit whining about it. Play music if you don't like peeling logs. Play a book on tape. Do something to entertain your mind while you peel the damn logs. You need to have contracts with folks that say some of it will be hard, dirty, heavy work.
I think any time you build a house, it's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people who live in a house and have never built a house, probably cannot fathom the amount of work that goes into building a house. Now,
and how much of the work is heavy, dirty, dangerous,
and
boring and repetitious, and you don't feel stimulated. So what you need to do is guard against what I call empowered youth. I mean entitled. I don't mean empowered. I mean entitled. I want people to be empowered. Entitled. Entitlement is a thing you'll see more and more these days in people under 40, having to do with child-rearing practices and school practices in recent decades, which ends up with you having a young adult like this. Excuse me, but when are my vacation days, and do I get vacation with pay? Listen, I like a certain kind of coffee, and I want it to have a lot, a lot of air, and do you have a cappuccino machine? And it's like the young person rather believes and expects that certain perks and entitlements will be theirs. Why? Because they're entitled, and they look at you with a look that sort of says, and I want you to provide me this, and I want you to provide me that, and I expect to have this, and I expect to have that. And they have no clue how you behave in the real adult world. So I always say no to folks like that when I'm getting somebody as a work exchanger or a new incoming Earth Haven member. And what we look for is people whose parents raised them with a sense of that you learn stuff as you learn it, and you earn the right to have certain perks and privileges. You earn it. You show your stuff, you know?
So this is the exact space that we're in at the moment where people are telling me that the way we're doing things here is all wrong because we're allowing all the gappers to come into the house and literally eat with us at our table.
Well, you're supposed to do that. That's why they want to be there, so they can meet you and learn from you. You're interesting to them. Let them meet you at dinner time.
And what I'm being told is that the thing we need to do is we need to set up a different building that they can live in to their own standards. And then they're not going to learn unless they're subjected to each other. And as opposed to having, because the problem that we're having is that we run, it's a small space.
Mm-hmm. The kitchen.
And so, well, the kitchen and the living room, I mean, this is the world's tiniest little double wide.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like this is where our base of operations is while we get work done up on the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got, like oftentimes we'll have meals and it'll be 12 people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not, there's a small living room. And what's happening is to say everybody just simply cleans up after themselves. But there are, every morning there's lots of dishes out. People came and got a snack and then they left their stuff out. And so part of it's this whole area of like, well, we could set up security cameras throughout the house, and then somebody could analyze the tapes, and then we can say, you, Bob, are a fucking pig. And because we asked, who left this out? And, of course, nobody left it out.
Except that there's a very basic remedy for this that you probably may have not have thought of, so I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
How do work exchangers get fed and cleaned up after? How they do it is there's a work exchanger for whom that is their job.
We've done that. And
you
people
you get
are
them
not
to come in the first place who has that skill.
The people, we assign sections, then the people, some people do it. Some people have done a lovely job, and it's like, okay, you're in charge of this.
No, I don't mean that.
Oh, no.
Let's back up.
Backing up.
Okay. When you're getting your work exchangers through whatever ways you do, which might be Craigslist and might be the Woofer website and these other things, you say, we need a cook and kitchen manager.
Mm-hmm.
And this person will have the following privileges and will do the following tasks and will have this much free time and da-da-da-da-da. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they might not do 3 meals a day, 7 days a week, because that's a lot of work.
No.
They might do 3 meals a day, 5 days a week, or something like that. And then somebody else does the other ones. But this person is in charge of shopping, making the lists, or getting people to go buy the stuff that they want. They're in charge of meal planning. They're in charge of the cooking, and they're in charge of giving instructions to the assistant cooks, and they're in charge of giving instructions to the people who clean up. They do work, but they also instruct others. They're in charge. They didn't come there to learn how to build a wofati or other kinds of stuff you're doing there. They came there just to do that. Why? They wanted an adventure, and they already have these skills.
Yep.
They love to cook. They
this
love
is the food. Level 9 mom.
Well, yeah, or the level 9 work exchanger who's good at cooking. So there are work exchanger cook people
yeah.
who may want to have some free time and learn these other things, but you can't really offer that to them because they're going to be in the kitchen most of the time. What do they want to be there for? Because Montana's beautiful. There's cool people to meet.
Right.
Right?
Oh, yeah, no, you're singing to the choir, baby. No. And what we've gotten for that position has been people that excel at, like, one aspect, you know, and then they don't do the others. And so you just list it off, and they're going to cook most of the meals, and they're going to buy the food, and they're going to, you know, also see to it that the people that are filling in the other roles are doing a good job. And it's like, so what we'll do is we'll get somebody who's really good at cooking the meals, but we'll never buy any food.
Okay,
and,
so
and they won't monitor anybody else.
Yeah.
They'll, you know, and it's like, so try to find somebody else who will, like, fill in these positions. Like, maybe you mix and match people, and eventually you'll come up with a solution. And it's like, no, we've had universal failure so far.
Okay, then, if you're thinking you'd like to pay a level 9 kitchen manager mom, great. That will work. I'm sure it will work. It's just that you can sometimes have a work exchanger whose specialty is management of kitchens and or cooking. I mean, I've seen it, you know.
Oh, yeah. I've seen it so many times, I was sure that this was the easy part.
Well, you may not be well enough known yet. I don't mean you, Paul. I mean your place, you know.
Right.
So you're developing a reputation just like the Bullock Brothers Farm is, and that there will come a time probably. The only thing is, somebody who really wants to learn cool permaculture stuff from Wolfati to you know, heaters to everything else may not want to be in the kitchen. So you might have to somebody who doesn't give two figs for permaculture and says permanent what, but they're way cool in doing what they do.
See, now the Bullock Brothers Farm, one that you just mentioned, then their thing is that there are three houses on the property that are occupied by each of the Bullock brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And the skill builders, or woofers, do not go in there without an express invitation. But what they do get is they get that lovely kind of the Sky Lodge thing, and then the outdoor kitchen that's got the plastic tarp over it. And then they got their own tents and things like that. That's all good for the skill builders.
Well, there's two ways to do it, and they're both good, and it depends on what the group wants, the farm, the organization, or the community wants. Some communities, like Emerald Earth in Northern California, know very well that people who want to come to a community want to enjoy shared community life with others, and that's part of what the draw is. It's not that they have very special stuff that they can teach them, although they can teach them natural building. But it's because they want to do community life. So they come and they do various jobs and tasks in their work exchanger role, and they share 3 meals a day with the other community members, which is really fun. They share in the community life, the social life, the entertainment life, the playing of guitars, the going into the sauna, all the stuff that they do there. And it's very, very pleasant. Siebenlinden, a very big eco-village in Germany that has about 100 people in several different small neighborhoods, they have a neighborhood specifically for work exchangers, and they get work exchangers who stay there a year and who are all young. And the name of this program starts with a Z, and I forget what the word is in German, but it's a putting together two words meaning youth and year. Anyway, they have this youth year program where young people come for a year, stay there a year, and they do all of the cooking and cleanup work in the kitchen for the whole community. But they don't stay in the different neighborhoods. They stay in their own neighborhood with their own building, which is very nice. And why are they there? Partly they're there to be at Way Cool Siebenlinden, which means 7 linden trees. Sieben, 7. Oh, you know that because you speak a little German.
No,
Linden.
I don't. No.
Oh, I thought you
I tried. Knew. I tried. I failed.
I thought that since you knew Sepp Holzer, you probably speak ein kleines bisschen Deutsch. But anyway, the other thing is that they want to meet each other. Why? Because they're some of the coolest young people traveling all around Europe, going to different eco-villages and doing way cool things. So their social life with other cool youth is part of a draw. Now, the Siebenlinden folks know this. So they offer this year, this youth year thing. Isn't that cool?
That is interesting. I'm baffled at the year. I mean, I kind
of
feel
like...
Oh, I
now remember what it's called, the Jungenjahren. It's not a Z, it's a J. Jungen, young people, year.
All right. I think that you're going to get a lot of people that are going to say that they're going to, hi, I'm here forever, and then that means a week. And then there's other people that are like, I'm here for a week, and then it turns out to be that they're here forever.
You need a contract with a specific period of time.
I don't like the idea of a contract with a specific period of time, because if they don't like being here, I don't want them to stick around.
Right, but the contract is not that kind of contract. It doesn't say you have to stay. It says, these are our agreements, and then you make them be the way you want. We reserve the right to ask you to leave if we want you to. You reserve the right to leave early if you want to, but it has to be for a good reason, and you forfeit your deposit.
Oh, they forfeit their deposit the second that they send it.
There could be another deposit. You see,
okay.
You get what I'm saying.
A series of deposits. Now give us more money.
The point is, you need to have more clear structure, in my opinion, if you want work exchanges to work out well. And I'm saying this not just for you,
here's what we've
but
learned
for the
so
listeners
far.
Who might want work exchanges in their place. And we probably both should get off the phone pretty soon.
We should get off the phone very soon.
Having flat ear syndrome, Paul.
here's what I've learned so far. Is the people that have listened to, like, more than half the podcasts that arrive here, they work out fantastic. And then the people that have listened to zero or maybe just a dozen, then that's like, you know, that's a gamble. We don't know how it'll work out. We'll see. And sometimes it works out fine, and sometimes it doesn't work out.
Uh-huh.
Now I'm looking at the eighth person to come and indicate to me that my time is up. thank you so much, Diana, and we're going to have to do this again very, very soon. If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about intentional community, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.